toner. This concludes the death notices for today.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local...
Good morning. You're listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information located in Lowell, Massachusetts. We read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. LAB Radio is brought to you by the volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. This is Diane, and I will be reading from the Eagle Tribune. I will be joined by Richard eventually, who will be reading from The Sun. Lab would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. Okay, front page of the Eagle Tribune on Friday, January 9th. Market for all seasons, from corny jokes to oh my god meatballs. Okay. So out of Salem, New Hampshire, shoppers stroll to Mary A. Fisk Elementary School. I'm sorry, shoppers stroll to Mary A. Fisk Elementary School from the parking lot this Sunday morning. Some are here for the crisp winter greens, root vegetables, and locally raised meat. Also for artisan foods or to get knives sharpened or to be entertained. They are mostly families or couples, tote bags tucked under their arms, bound for the Salem, New Hampshire Farmers Market. One of the few year-round weekly farmers markets in New Hampshire and Massachusetts, it's now in its winter season after a summer under white canopy tents outside the mall at Rockland Park a mile away. Lauren Perry, unlike the other shoppers, is headed out of the market, having gotten here earlier with her family. She pulls a small cart with a cooler to the far corner where her husband and kids wait in their tall black van. The family of eight lives in North Andover and have been coming to the market for 2 years, a 20-minute drive from Interstate 495 to Route 213 to Interstate 93. We've been coming long enough that most people know us, Perry says, after loading the cooler and its 6 gallons of milk from Brookford Farm, one of the market vendors and what's originally drew them to the market. She and her husband, Mark, say their kids look forward to seeing the vendors, getting croissants from Woodman's Artisan Bakery, soy candles from the Good Llama Company, and treats for their two dogs. The balloon guy's here, she says. That would be balloon artist Mr. Joe Tom Barello of Silly Solutions, a traveling entertainer who works fairs, schools, and events with fellow acts like Jenny the Juggler, Big League Brian, and Magic Mike. Tom Barello's station sits along the hallway as people enter the school. Purple and blue balloons appear to defy the laws of physics as they wheel above him, spinning in midair. Spoiler alert, an air current works the magic. Tom Barello dons on Boston's scally cap, white shirt, black tie, and brace suspenders, uncorks jokes, unvarnished corn, and gags made golf goofier by bell and whistle sound effects. He entertains a brother and sister. You want something funny? You want something big? You want something small? He asks the sister. She wants a hat. You came to the right guy. All right, you want a small hat? You want a medium hat? She wants a big one, purple and blue. Tom Barello waves his sound effects over the balloons as they fill with air. He pretends to shake salt and pepper on the length, then twists and shapes it. He acts hurt when the kids laugh at his jokes. Just ahead at a desk by the entrance to the market proper is a manager Colleen Jennings. She swipes cards from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program receipt and hands out tokens that more than double the value of their purchase. Someone who spends $50 of SNAP benefits can purchase $130 worth of food. The market receives a small but steady share of its business from SNAP customers, about 35 people per week on average year-round. The first week of the month, the market gives veterans $20 vouchers. This week, before, 90 veterans were among the 500 shoppers, says Susan Nelson, one of 5 part-time market employees. The Salem Market was started 15 years ago by Jane Lang, a local activist who is in her retirement inspired volunteers and vendors to join her in making the market a hub of friendship, nutritious, locally sourced food, and locally made products. To this day, the market remains committed to her vision. Lang died in March of 2016 at the age of 68, and a memorial was held here at Fisk before the market opened. Many of her original vendors remain at the market. The winter market includes 2 rooms where dozens of businesses sell their products, some of them selling locally sourced meat, fish, fruits, and vegetables. Gavin Williams, a Londonderry farmer from Victory Aquaponics, is selling fancy lettuce that live up to their name. They are bright and the curving leaves uniform and vibrant. He grows his plants year-round. Instead of synthetic nutrients, they draw on organic nutrients that come from freshwater fish living in the same water where the lettuce and other edibles grow. Nearby in the first big market room is a station run by Hampton's Herd Farm, selling fresh grass-fed beef and free-range chickens, as well as pork, chicken, and turkey. Farm stands in both of the market's rooms sell root vegetables, including carrots, turnips, and a variety of squashes and potatoes. The first station in the second room belongs to the meatball king, Richie Baresi. Baresi pumps out music, including Tony Bennett tunes, and offers customers samples of his meatballs. His recipe borrows heavily from family. His grandmother, Providencia meatballs, the ones she fed him as a child. She was originally from Sicily. Baresi is an executive chef at St. Anselm College in Manchester, where he cooks for the monks. The year 2024 was a banner one for Baresi. He won the 3 meatball titles, St. Peter's Club in Gloucester, the Fisherman's Feast in Boston, and the Grape and Italian Festival in Hollis. Among the longtime vendors at Salem Market is Steve Anderson of Anderson's Mini Maples in Deerfield. He makes maple syrup and candy and can answer questions with a single word, maybe 2, if he's feeling chatty. He has been tapping trees for sap and boiling it down over a wood fire. It takes 40 gallons of sap for a single gallon of syrup since the early 1970s. Anderson puts a tablespoon of maple syrup in his coffee every morning. The fellow across from him at the market, Tom Polinka, puts a small amount of Anderson's maple syrup in his marinara sauce. Polinka and his wife, Diane of Salem, own Slippery Soap Company and make and sell goat milk soap, moisturizers, and other body care products. Variety is the spice of Salem Market. Expect the unexpected. Everything from pickles to pottery, alpaca knits to microgreens. Up from Reading, Massachusetts, is a father and daughter selling sauces. Big Rich's gourmet hot sauce and marinade. Rich Moyat and his daughter, Taylor Scopa, squeeze sauces onto tiny tablespoons for visitors. Scopa says that her dad has been making these sauces for 17 years. He started making it for the family where, like, we wanted our own sauce. We wanted our own flavors, she says. The original is the flavor of my childhood. Outside the market, operating a mobile tool and knife sharpening truck, Sharp Shop is at Alan Baxter and his son Paul, a retired Haverhill firefighter. Several customers stop by their van within 5 minutes, dropping off knives to be sharpened while they are inside shopping at the market. Among the customers are Derry residents Dee Oberlin and Megan McKenzie. They started coming to the market last summer and just last week brought a few knives from Sharp Shop. This week, they brought in some of their old knives to get sharpened. Meanwhile, they will head into the market to buy some vegetables and see what they see. It's always a different experience, Oberlin says. Oh, it's great, she says. There's usually like some kind of music playing, different people around. The market serves fun and health for the whole family and everyone else, a year-round venture for the sellers and a year-round venture for the visitors. Well, over to you, Richard.
All right. Good morning, everybody. Hope the new year is better for everybody. We're expecting rain today, late in the day, and the temperature is going to be a 45 high, 36 low. Well, okay, the banner has potential misuse of taxpayers' funds. So there's going to be a fraud audit. The Patriots, veteran safety, enjoying breakout season. And nutrition has garlic and herb salmon with spinach and couscous. Hmm. Well, crime, not so good. Lowell man is accused of shooting mother's boyfriend, ruled dangerous. No bail is granted. Prosecutors say victim has been released from the hospital. Article is by Aaron Curtis of the Lowell Sun. A Lowell District Court judge has ordered 21-year-old Devin Sauvan held without bail after ruling on Tuesday that he poses a danger to the public following a 58A dangerousness hearing tied to the shooting of his mother's boyfriend. Judge Patrick Burke agreed with the Middlesex District Attorney's Office, who argued Sauvan, charged with several crimes, including armed assault with intent to murder, should remain in custody as the case moves forward. The ruling stems from the December 30th incident in which Sauvan allegedly shot 44-year-old Robert Connor in the midst of an argument inside their apartment at 22 South Walker Street. It was reported in an emergency radio broadcast moments after the shooting that Connor had suffered gunshot wounds to the arm and abdomen. A Lowell police incident report stated that an officer found Connor inside the third-floor apartment with an abdomen wound and what appeared to be an exit wound to his back. He was flown by medical helicopter to Leahy Hospital Medical Center in Burlington for surgery. The Middlesex District Attorney's Office announced something. Page 8. Okay. Page 8 is coming. Page 8. Where is it? 2, 5, 6. Well, where is 8? 6, 7. All right, let's see what we got here. All right, here we go. Wednesday, that Connor has since been released from the hospital. According to police incident reports, which included interviews with family members who reside at the South Walker Street home, Connor and Sauvan frequently argued, as they had on the day of the shooting. Sauvan's mother told investigators she tried to keep the two separate when the confrontation escalated. Sauvan later told police that the dispute intensified when Connor got in his face and at that point picked up a chair as if to hit him with it. Okay. At about 3:30 p.m., Sauvan went to his bedroom, retrieved a handgun, moved his mother out of the way, and allegedly shot Connor in the abdomen. According to police reports, as Connor tried to flee, Sauvan said he followed him and fired two additional rounds. Oops. Sauvan's 19-year-old brother told police he was in his bedroom when he heard the arguing followed by two or three shots. When he stepped out of his bedroom, he found Connor on the floor with blood on his robe. Connor said, "Go get a cloth," but didn't seem like he could say anything else, the brother told investigators. Sauvan's mother applied pressure to the wound with a towel while 911 was called. Ooh. The 19-year-old brother also told police he knew Sauvan had a gun because Sauvan had previously shown it to him. The mother of Sauvan's child later told investigators he kept the firearm under his pillow or beneath his bed. Yeah. After the shooting, Sauvan fled the apartment and went to a friend's home on Stevens Street. Oh. Where police later found him sleeping and arrested him without incident. He told detectives he tossed the gun into a dumpster in the area of Wilder and Pine Street. Okay. In addition to armed assault with intent to murder, Sauvan is charged with assault and battery with a dangerous weapon, assault and battery causing serious bodily injury, and possession of a firearm without a license. Yeah. A Lowell police incident report entered as evidence during Tuesday's 58A hearing also detail a prior arrest involving Sauvan. In October 2023, he was charged with assault with a dangerous weapon after allegedly pointing what was later determined to be a pellet gun at a 43-year-old man downtown. The man, believing the weapon was real, fled into a Market Street restaurant and told employees to call the police. Officers tracked down Sauvin with the pellet gun, and the victim identified him as a suspect. The outcome of that case was not immediately available. Under Burke's order, on Tuesday, Sauvin can be held up for up to 120 days if the case remained unresolved at that point. Prosecutors may seek another 58A hearing to request that he continue to be held. Sauvin is scheduled to return to court for a probational cause hearing February 6th. His attorney, Janine Mercury, was not available for comments about Tuesday's hearing. Okay.
I've got Santa Fund raises $61,000 to brighten the holidays out of North Andover. This year, the Eagle Tribune's annual Santa Fund helped 291 people in need have a joyful and healthy holiday season and feel supported by their community with funds raised by generous donors. As of Thursday, more than $61,300 was raised through generous contributions from the community, local businesses, and organizations. Since 1924, the tradition has provided local families in need in the Merrimack Valley and southern New Hampshire with gifts and food for the holidays. Donations help brighten children's days with gifts to open and contribute to a festive, warm meal for families to share. Now, in its 101st year, the Santa Fund is in partnership with Merrimack Valley YMCA, which administers the program. The YMCA team works with community organizations to distribute the gifts and foods to the families. More than 2,100 gifts and clothing items were purchased, wrapped, and delivered from funds raised this year. 291 individuals in the community who benefited ranged from 89-year-olds to a baby not yet born. Gifts included presents and grocery store gift cards. Many YMCA volunteers worked to ensure every child's wish came true, fulfilling unique requests like volleyball gear for a teenager starting the sport and crocodile-shaped slippers. Planetarium projectors to transform bedroom ceilings into starry skies were also some of the gifts children asked for. Other popular requests included Lego sets, Barbie dolls in Bluey and Sonic toys. Recipients also received at least 3 clothing items and a pair of shoes in addition to gifts. The Santa Fund team consisted of 63 volunteers, including the YMCA's Adelante program, who help shop, wrap, and spread holiday cheer. Volunteers begin in the fall to manage the Santa Fund. Olivia LeDuc, the YMCA's philanthropy administrator, managed the operation, coordinating every gift for every child and ensuring every detail from donation to wrapping was covered. Teens from the Lawrence YMCA shopped from family wish lists at the Methuen Target in December and later wrapped some of the gifts. YMCA board member Michelle Shea took wrapping strangely shaped objects to a whole new level, while corporate partner Borislow Insurance sent an entire team to help wrap hundreds of gifts. Others like volunteer Tish Bachman and Lawrence Board of Advisors member Debbie Schmidt shared their expertise as a longtime Santa Fund coordinator with the rest of the Santa Fund team for another successful year. Donations for the Santa Fund can still be made through January 14th at the Santa Fund, and you could call to find the Tribune, not the Tribune, you can call to find out about that, how to donate. Okay, over to you, Richard.
All right, well, this is a bit weird one. I don't know how this guy knew where to go. Crime. Lowell man is charged in the Boston City Hall theft. All right. Boston police say they have nabbed the masked suspect who entered private office suites in Boston City Hall during work hours and stole wallets stuffed with cash, credit cards from multiple employees, knowing where to go. The Boston Police Department identified Darren O'Neill, 60, of Lowell, as a suspect involved in the City Hall thefts, which occurred last month on December 1st. O'Neill was already being held after a prior shoplifting arrest at Dick's House of Sports on Boylston Street when he was identified as the alleged perpetrator of the City Hall crime, following what the cops described as an extensive investigation, Boston police said on Wednesday. Three City Hall employees reported that their wallets, which contained cash, credit cards, health savings account cards, personal IDs, were stolen from their offices, per Boston police reports. One woman who had her wallet snatched out of her purse with two credit cards, page 5. I mean, how does this guy even know where to go to get this stuff stolen? All right. ID, Massachusetts driver's license, insurance and library cards, and $100 in cash told police two of her co-workers saw an unknown man in the area who was wearing a brown beanie, dark jacket, sweatpants, and a blue face mask. Two other employees told police that not only were cash and credit cards stolen from their offices, but the thief used the cards to rack up hundreds of dollars in unauthorized purchases, totaling $1,500 at Macy's and Walgreens. Pretty fast operator. The incidents led to calls from two city councilors, Ed Flynn and Aaron Murphy, for the city to tighten up security protocols in light of the intrusion and theft, which occurred during work hours and was described by both as a security breach. Mayor Michelle Wu's office said a day later that steps have already been taken to increase security after the incident, which involved unauthorized access to several office suites that are restricted to authorized personnel only. So how did this guy get in? Municipal Protective Services, which provides security for city buildings, has increased in internal patrol patrols throughout City Hall as a result of the incident, the mayor's office said. O'Neill was arrested on shoplifting charges on the 27th of December at 760 Boylston Street after he was seen inside Dick's House of Sports concealing merchandise, police said. Police said they had responded to the store at 11:39 a.m. for a report of a theft in progress. While police approached, O'Neill was seen exiting the sporting goods store. The cops were able to quickly stop the suspect and could see clothing with tags affixed to them inside of a bag, police said. During a search, about $408 of stolen merchandise was recovered, police said. For the shoplifting incident, O'Neill was arrested and charged with larceny under $1,200 and being a common and notorious thief. Common and notorious? After further investigation, police said they determined that O'Neill had seven active warrants for his arrest for charges of four counts of larceny from a building and three counts of receiving stolen property under $1,200 and two counts of larceny of a credit card, shoplifting by asportation? Okay. Credit card fraud under $1,200 and shoplifting by concealing merchandise. After O'Neill was identified as the alleged City Hall thief, police said they sought additional criminal complaints in Boston Municipal Court on charges of two counts of larceny from a building, two counts of credit card fraud under $1,200, and being a common and notorious thief. O'Neill is expected to be in Boston Municipal Court at a later date. Following the Boston Police Department's announcement on Wednesday, Flynn said larceny and the retail theft must be a top priority for our city. Larceny and retail theft must be a top priority for our city. But he got into all these offices, pocketbooks and everything. He must have zero tolerance for any type of theft. And those arrested must be held accountable in our court system for their criminal behavior, Flynn told the Herald. Murphy said, this incident was unacceptable, and I am glad the individual responsible has been arrested. My focus throughout has been on employee safety and securing City Hall offices. City Hall must be a safe workplace, and this incident underscores the importance of secure offices and prompt action. Mayor Wu's office did not immediately respond to a request for comment on police identification of the alleged City Hall larceny suspect.
Weesh. Okay. Yeah. I've got Healy tops $250 million to offset rising premiums. Boston. The Healy administration is pumping an additional $250 million into the state-subsidized healthcare system to help offset the impact of now-expired federal tax credits, which have driven up premiums for many people insured through the federal healthcare exchange. On Thursday, Governor Maura Healey and other state officials said they are moving ahead with plans to increase spending on the Connector Care program by $250 million for a total of $600 million this fiscal year. Healey called it the largest state investment in the country and said it means about 270,000 people enrolled in Connector Care whose incomes are below 400% of the federal poverty level will see little to no premium increases because of the expiring federal credits. Massachusetts families cannot afford President Trump's drastic increases to their health insurance premiums, Healy, a Democrat, said Thursday. While Washington raises costs, we're working hard to lower them. It's why we capped health care deductibles and copays for the first time, as well as the cost of insulin and inhalers. We will continue to do all we can to make health care more affordable in this state, she said. The Healy administration said the tranche of new funding will also help lower other out-of-pocket costs such as copays and deductibles for Connect Care recipients. The funding comes from the Commonwealth Care Trust Fund, which is funded in part by health care premiums, tobacco tax collections, and other sources of revenue. This continued commitment means hundreds of thousands of Massachusetts residents can continue to afford care that there's for them when they need it, keeping them healthy and financially secure, Audrey Morse Gastier, the collector's executive director, said in remarks Thursday. Health insurance premiums for an estimated 24 million Americans who get their coverage through the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, are due to rise by double digits this year after Congress failed to take action before the end of 2025 to extend the subsidies. More than 328,000 Massachusetts residents who get their health insurance through the federal exchange had received notices about their premiums doubling, in some cases tripling. This because the tax credits approved during the COVID-19 pandemic are expiring, according to state health officials. On Thursday, the U.S. House was poised to pass bipartisan legislation extending conscientious Obamacare tax credits for 3 years. The bill would still need to pass the Senate before landing on Trump's desk for consideration. Healy had previously urged Republicans and President Trump to support the Democratic plan earlier this week, warning that people will go without health care coverage if the subsidies aren't extended. Extending the Obamacare subsidies was Democrats' principal objective during the 43-day shutdown, the longest in U.S. history. Republicans say the COVID-related subsidies are no longer needed because the pandemic is over. That's not true. And argue they create opportunities for waste, fraud, and abuse while driving up the overall cost of healthcare premiums. They've pointed out that even though the subsidies are reduced, they won't go away. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimated a Democratic proposal to extend the credits for another 3 years would add nearly $83 billion to the federal deficit over the next decade. It would also increase the number of people with subsidized health insurance by 8.5 million by 2029, the office said. Healthcare coverage is one of the biggest is one of the state's biggest expenses, and its efforts to ensure people will retain health care coverage are likely to increase those costs for taxpayers. The cost of Massachusetts Health, the state's Medicaid program, which serves more than 2 million or roughly one in every three people, has doubled in the past decade and now accounts for nearly 40% of overall spending. Over to you, Richard.
All right, diplomacy. Denmark, Greenland meet with the White House officials. Talks follow Trump's remarks about a possible takeover. This is from the Associated Press. Washington. Denmark and Greenland's envoys to Washington have begun a vigorous effort to urge U.S. lawmakers, as well as key Trump administration officials, to step back from President Donald Trump's call for a takeover of the strategic Arctic island. Denmark's ambassador Jesper Møller Sørensen and Jacob Isbosetsen, Greenland's chief representative to Washington, met on Thursday with White House National Security Council officials to discuss a renewed push by Trump to acquire Greenland, perhaps by military force, according to Danish government officials who were not authorized to comment publicly and spoke on the condition of anonymity. The White House did not respond to a request for a comment about the meeting. The envoys have also held a series of meetings this week with American lawmakers as they look to enlist help in persuading Trump to back off his threat. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is expected to meet next week with Danish officials. Trump, in a New York Times interview published Thursday, said he has to possess the entirety of the Greenland instead of just exercising a long-standing treaty that gives the United States wide latitude to use Greenland for military posts. I think that ownership gives you a thing that you can't do with, you're talking about a lease or a treaty. Ownership gives you things and elements that you can't get from just signing a document, Trump told the newspaper. The U.S. is party to a 1951 treaty that gives it broad rights to set up military bases there with the consent of Denmark and Greenland. Meanwhile, Trump's Vice President, J.D. Vance, told reporters that European leaders should take the President of the United States seriously as he framed the issue as one of defense. What we're asking our European friends to do is take the security of that landmass more seriously, because if they're not, the United States is going to have to do something about it, Vance said. But the administration is starting to hear pushback from lawmakers, including some Republicans, about Trump's designs on the territory. In a floor speech Thursday, Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican of Alaska, warned that the rhetoric from some of the Trump administration is profoundly troubling. "We've got a lot ahead of us in 2026, Murkowski said. Greenland, or taking Greenland, or buying Greenland, should not be on that list. It should not be an obsession at the highest levels of this administration." Here we go on. Danish officials are hopeful about the upcoming talks with Rubio in Washington. "This is the dialogue that is needed, as requested by the government, together with the Greenlandic government," Danish Defense Minister Troels Lund Poulsen told Danish broadcaster DR. The island of Greenland, 80% of which lies above the Arctic Circle, is home to about 56,000 mostly Inuit people. That's like Alaskan Eskimo people. Vance criticized Denmark. Vance said on Wednesday that Denmark obviously had not done a proper job in securing Greenland and that Trump is willing to go as far as he has to defend American interests in the Arctic. In an interview with Fox News, Vance repeated Trump's claim that Greenland is crucial to both the U.S. and the world's national security because the entire missile defense infrastructure is partially dependent on Greenland. Mm-hmm. He said the fact that Denmark has been a faithful military ally of the U.S. during World War II and the more recent war on terrorism did not necessarily mean they were doing enough to secure Greenland today. Just because you did something smart 25 years ago doesn't mean you can't do something dumb now, Vance said, adding that Trump is saying very clearly you are not doing a good job with respect to Greenland. Earlier, Rubio told a select group of U.S. lawmakers that it was the Republican administration's intention to eventually purchase Greenland as opposed to using military force. Many Greenlanders feel that the remarks made are disrespectful. Aja Chemnitz, one of the two Greenlandic politicians in the Danish parliament, told the Associated Press, many also experienced that these conversations are being discussed over their heads. We have a firm saying in Greenland, nothing about Greenland without Greenland. She said most Greenlanders wish for more self-determination, including independence, but also want to strengthen cooperation with our partners in security and business development, as long as it is based on mutual respect and recognition of our right to self-determination. Chemnitz denied a claim by Trump that Greenland is covered with Russian and Chinese ships all over the place. Okay. Greenland is a longstanding ally and partner to the U.S., and we have a shared interest in stability, security, and responsible cooperation in the Arctic, she said. There is an agreement with the U.S. that gives them access to have bases in Greenland if needed. Okay, here goes. France's President Emmanuel Macron has denounced the law of the strongest that is making people wonder if Greenland will be invaded. In a speech to French ambassadors at the Élysée Presidential Palace on Thursday, Macron said, it's the greatest disorder, the law of the strongest, and everyday people wonder whether Greenland will be invaded, whether Canada will be under the threat of becoming the 51st state of the United States, or whether Taiwan is to be further circled. He pointed to an increasingly dysfunctional world where great powers, including the U.S. and China, have a real temptation to divide the world amongst themselves. The United States is gradually turning away from some of its allies and freeing itself from the international rules, Macron said. The leaders of Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Poland, Spain, and the UK joined Denmark's Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen on Tuesday in defending Greenland's sovereignty in the wake of Trump's comments about Greenland, which is part of the NATO military alliance. After Vance's visit to Greenland last year, Danish Foreign Minister Lars Løkke Rasmussen published a video detailing the 1951 defense agreement between Denmark and the U.S. Since 1945, the American military presence in Greenland has decreased from thousands of soldiers over 17 bases and installations on the island, Rasmussen said, to the remote Pituffik Space Base in the northwest with only 200 soldiers today. The base supports missile warning, missile defense, and space surveillance operations from the U.S. So you've gone from 1,700... Oh, I'm sorry. No. But it was thousands, I guess it was, to 200 soldiers. The 1951 agreement offers ample opportunity for the United States to have a much stronger military presence in Greenland, Rasmussen said. If that is what you wish, then let's discuss it. Last year, Denmark's top parliament approved a bill to allow the U.S. military bases on Danish soil. The legislation widens a previously military agreement made in 2023 with the Biden administration, where U.S. troops had broad access to Danish air bases in the Scandinavian country. Denmark is also moving to strengthen its military presence around Greenland and in the wider North Atlantic. Last year, the government announced a $2.3 billion agreement with parties including the governments of Greenland and the Faroe Islands, another self-governing territory of Denmark, to improve capabilities for surveillance and maintaining sovereignty in the region. Well, kind of chilly in here.
It's always chilly in there.
Yeah. All right. Go ahead, dear.
Okay. Displaced Middleton jail inmates sent to other lockups. Out of Middleton, nearly a quarter of the inmates at Middleton jail have been transferred to other correctional facilities across the state after a fire Tuesday evening, Essex County Sheriff Kevin Kupinger said. Some 179 of 765 inmates were temporarily relocated to correctional facilities in Middlesex, Suffolk, Norfolk, and Worcester counties, Kupinger said Thursday afternoon. An investigation continues to determine the exact cause of an underground electrical explosion that resulted in significant damage to the 240 building, the largest housing unit at Manning Avenue Jail. The fire broke out at 6:30 p.m. Tuesday, forcing the immediate evacuation of 407 inmates to the jail yard and later available buildings on the property. Kupinger said the Essex County Sheriff's Department coordinated extensively with these partner agencies to ensure continuity of medical care, including medication assistance treatment where applicable, for the displaced inmates. Visitation at Middleton Jail is expected to resume Monday. Inmates continue to have access to tablets and telephones to communicate with loved ones. Limited recreation and religious services remain available. However, educational programming has been temporarily suspended. Attorneys may continue to meet with clients on site, though some delays may occur, Kupinger said. Additional Sheriff's Department personnel remain on duty to ensure the continued safety and security of inmates and staff. The fire's cause is believed to be accidental, and Kupinger said a new large generator was delivered to the jail late Wednesday afternoon. Kupinger said Thursday afternoon the 240 building remained offline with limited power supplied by the large-scale generator to provide heat and other essential functions as the damage assessment continued. While the Sheriff's Department is working to restore the building as quickly as possible, there is no estimated timeline for when it will return to full operation. The total cost of the damage has not been determined, Kupinger said. Kupinger has praised Sheriff's Department employees and inmates for their response to the emergency Tuesday night. The jail, built in 1990, has a maximum capacity of roughly 1,250 inmates. Preliminary findings indicate the explosion occurred within an underground conduit connecting an external transformer to an internal breaker panel serving the 240 building. We understand the disruption and inconvenience this accident has caused for families, attorneys, and those in our care, and I sincerely apologize for that, Kupinger said. Our staff and partners are working around the clock to fully access the damage and restore the 240 building as quick and safely as possible. While safety must come first, we are committed to returning operations to normal as soon as conditions allow. Over to you, Richard.
All right, Washington. House advances bill to extend health care subsidiaries. All right. Again, Associated Press from Washington. In a remarkable rebuke of Republican leadership, the House passed legislation Thursday, 230-196, that would extend expired health care subsidies for those who get coverage through the Affordable Care Act, as 17 renegade GOP lawmakers join every Democrat in voting for the measure. Okay. Forcing the issue to a vote came about after a handful of Republicans signed on to a so-called discharge petition to unlock debate, bypassing objections from House Speaker Mike Johnson. The bill now goes to the Senate, where pressure is building for a bipartisan compromise. Together, the rare political coalitions are rushing to resolve the standoff over the enhanced tax credits that were put in place during the COVID-19 crisis, but expired late last year after no agreement was reached during the government shutdown. The affordability crisis is not a hoax. It is very real, despite what Donald Trump has had to say, said House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries, invoking the president's remarks. Democrats made clear before the government was shut down, that we were in this affordability fight until we win this affordability fight, he said. Today we have an opportunity to take a meaningful step forward. Ahead of voting, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimated that the bill, which would provide a three-year extension of the subsidy, would increase the nation's deficit by about $80.6 billion over the decade. At the same time, it would increase the number of people with health insurance by 100,000 this year and 3 million in 2027 and 4 million in 2028 and 1.1 million in 2029, the CBO said. That's the Congressional Budget Office. That's what CBO stands for. Growing support for extending the Affordable Care Act subsidies. Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, worked for months to prevent this situation. His office argued Thursday that the federal health care funding from the COVID-19 era is rife with fraud and urged a no vote. On the floor, Republicans also argued that the lawmakers should be focused on lowering health insurance costs for the broader population, not just those involved or enrolled in the ACA plans. Only 7% of the population relies on Obamacare marketplace plans. This chamber should be about helping 100% of Americans, said Representative Jason Smith, the Republican chairman of the White House Ways and Means Committee. While the momentum from the vote shows the growing support for the tax breaks that have helped some 22 million Americans have access to health insurance, the Senate would be under no requirement to take up the House bill and has already rejected it once before. Instead, a small group of senators from both parties has been working on an alternative plan that would find support in both chambers and become law. Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, said that for any plan to find support in his chamber, it will need to have income limits to ensure that the financial aid is focused on those who most need the help. He and other Republicans also want to ensure that beneficiaries would have to at least pay a nominal amount for their coverage. Finally, Thune said there would need to be some expansion of health savings accounts which allow people to save money and withdraw it tax-free as long as the money is spent on qualified medical expenses. That could be tricky. Senator Jean Shaheen, Democrat of New Hampshire, who is part of the negotiations on reforms and subsidies for the Affordable Care Act, said there is agreement on addressing fraud in health care. We recognize that we have millions of people in this country who are going to lose or are losing or have lost their health insurance because they can't afford the premiums, Shaheen said. And so we're trying to see if we can't get some agreement that's going to help. And the sooner we can do this, the better. Trump has pushed Republicans to send money directly to Americans for health savings accounts so they can bypass the federal government and handle insurance on their own. That's a tricky thing. Democrats largely reject this idea as insufficient for covering the high cost of health care. Republicans go around their leaders. Blurry reading. The action by Republicans to force a vote has been an affront to Johnson and his leadership team, who essentially lost control of what comes to the House floor as the Republican lawmakers joined Democrats for the workaround. After last year's government shutdown failed to resolve the issue, Johnson had discussed allowing more politically vulnerable GOP lawmakers a chance to vote on another health care bill that would temporarily extend the subsidies while also adding changes. Doesn't say what the changes are. But after days of discussions, Johnson and the GOP leadership sided with the more conservative wing, which has assailed the subsidies as propping up the Affordable Care Act, which they considered a failed government program. He offered a modest proposal of health care reforms that was approved but has stalled. Well, that doesn't help. It was then that rank and file lawmakers took matters into their own hands as many of their constituents face soaring health insurance premiums beginning this month. Republican reps Brian Fitzpatrick, Robert Bresnahan, and Ryan McKenzie, all from Pennsylvania, and Mike Lawler of New York, signed the Democrats' petition, pushing it to the magic number of 218 needed to force a House vote. All four represent key swing districts whose races will help determine which party takes charge of the House next year.
I'm going to wrap up with this article. Commission okays conditions to revitalize building out of Andover. The Conservation Commission gives its seal of approval to a project to redevelopment the site of a historic building in Shawsheen Village and breathe new life into it as an educational hub for Merrimack College. The commission approved a wetlands notice of intent and order of conditions for the revitalization project submitted by Lupoli Companies at its meeting on Tuesday. The planning board approved the site plan last month. The project will develop the site of 305 North Main Street, which sits on 1.76 acres along the Shawshene River. The property features a historic three-story, 46,152-square-foot brick building and parking lot. American Woolen Company President William Wood originally owned the building, according to Andover Historic Preservation's website. Lupoli Companies plans to revitalize the building and its vacant office space, transforming the property into a higher education center to include classrooms, shared lab spaces, and faculty offices. Merrimack College plans to lease the space for several years. Work being done outside the building is within the commission's jurisdiction, including landscaping, the parking lot, compliance with the American Disabilities Act, changes to utilities, and stormwater improvements. The commission last heard the proposal on December 16th and continued the public hearing while further details concerning an access assessment off North Main Street to Shawshene River were worked out. The easement would allow people to use the river for recreational purposes. Conservation agent Benjamin Mead said the easement has been formalized and memorialized in a plan included in the order of condition permit. The ease is now clearly marked on the parking surface, along with loading and unloading for vehicles and boats to reach the river, Mead said. Kevin McDonahue, representing Lupoli Companies, said there are now signs included in the plan at access points at Balmoral Street and North Main Street, indicating public parking is available on a first-come, first-served basis. The plan also now includes a loading, drop-off, and pickup area for vehicles and for boats to bank. Commissioner Alexandra Driscoll was still concerned about flooding and where flood water from the building would go since the area has been prone to major flooding in the past century. McDonahue said a 100-year-old flood would fill a basement with water that pumps would not be able to keep up with, but electrical gear would move to the first floor. A transformer would be designed in accordance with all bylaws and the insurance requirements for a flood plan. There will be pumps in the basement to take in water and pump it out through the water quality stormwater units and back into the Shawshene River. He added that this is more about mitigation after a flood than trying to keep up with a flood. We are comfortable with the level of climate resiliency and do understand the risk, McDonald said. Commissioner Chair Donald Cooper said the recognition is that this is a building which floods, and the commission has required what it has able to on the issue. Okay, on that note, I think we're going to take our break, and we shall return in a few minutes. Thank you for listening thus far.
Impossibly romantic. You get access to places or people you once thought out of reach. Your optimism returns in full color. More highlights. A family milestone brings joy, wins in games, and you'll balance ambition and affection like a pro. Aquarius and Cancer adore you. Your lucky numbers are 8, 1, 3, 22, and 37. This has been Dottie.
This is Mary Ellen. Thank you for listening.
Here's the forecast for the Boston and South Shore area on the Talking Information Center from the National Weather Service. For today, partly sunny, temperatures in the upper 40s. Clouds move in for this evening, some showers, temperatures dropping to the upper 30s. For Saturday, cloudy, temperatures in the mid-40s. The sun rose this morning at 7:13, setting at 4:30 this afternoon. Stay tuned for more heading your way next on the Talking Information Center.
When it comes to making plans, you are the best.
What about those round trips that you plan in advance, which are perfect on your way there and perfect on your way back? Or those meetings with friends for which you make a group chat 3 months before so that nobody or anything is missing? Or your daughter's first birthday party? You planned it with such dedication that instead of the first, it felt like our quinces. The same way you plan each detail for those moments. Start planning to protect you and your loved ones from a natural disaster. Sign up for local weather and emergency alerts. Prepare an emergency kit and make a family communications plan. Protecting your family is the best plan you can make. Get started at ready.gov/plan.
Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WVDF Middleboro, WRRS Middleboro, WRRSLP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WVALLP Athol, WDJ and Framingham.
Coming up next on the Talking Information Center, it's the Washington Post. Please stay tuned.
Hello, this is Jean at the Talking Information Center reading the Washington Post for Friday, January 9, 2026. Minnesota leaders escalate dispute over federal handling of ICE shooting. By Mark Berman, David Nakamura, and Patrick Marley. Minnesota officials and federal authorities escalated their dispute Thursday over an immigration officer's fatal shooting of a woman in Minneapolis, with state leaders saying the Trump administration was blocking local agents from an FBI investigation into the killing and preventing them from accessing evidence. The move, a day after a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officer shot and killed 37-year-old Renee Nicole Good in Minneapolis, ignited protests there, outrage across the country, and sharp disagreements between the Trump administration and local and state authorities about what happened. On Thursday, Border Patrol agents were involved in a separate shooting in Portland, Oregon, when trying to apprehend an alleged undocumented immigrant in a traffic stop. The administration has repeatedly defended the ICE officer in Minneapolis and said he was protecting himself when Good threatened him with her vehicle. Vice President J.D. Vance on Thursday called Good's death a tragedy of her own making. Minnesota leaders have excoriated these claims, with Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey, Democrat, denouncing what he called a garbage narrative and bull from the administration. Governor Tim Walz, Democrat, said it is very, very difficult to believe a federal probe into the ICE shooting that excludes state investigators will lead to a fair outcome. I say that only because people in positions of power have already passed judgment, Walz said at a news conference Thursday. Video from the scene raises doubts about some parts of the administration's portrayals of the shooting. Footage showed that while the vehicle did move toward the ICE agent as he stood in front of it, he was able to move aside and fire at least two of his three shots from the side, according to a Washington Post analysis. The administration's decision to take sole control of the investigation, combined with President Donald Trump and other officials' staunch backing of the ICE officers' actions, marks a break from some past instances in which local, state, and federal officials worked together on high-profile probes, including in Minnesota. After then-Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd in 2020, prompting widespread social justice protests, the FBI and the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, BCA, a state agency, carried out a joint investigation. Minnesota has been a recurring target for Trump, his allies, and officials within the administration. Republicans have recently spotlighted cases of social services fraud in Minnesota, while Trump has vehemently lashed out at the state's large Somali immigrant population. In December, Trump ordered immigration officials to ramp up their presence in Minneapolis. A lawsuit filed that month by the American Civil Liberties Union of Minnesota said federal officials had violently subdued observers and protesters opposed to the immigration enforcement efforts. Good's killing prompted another wave of protests, with large crowds of demonstrators gathering on Minneapolis streets overnight Wednesday and again Thursday morning. Later in the day, Walz signed an executive order authorizing National Guard troops to be deployed and help keep the peace, ensure public safety, and allow for peaceful demonstrations. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi L. Noem on Thursday said that before the shooting in Minneapolis, individuals had followed our officers all day, had harassed them, had blocked them in. She again defended the ICE officer who killed Good, calling him an experienced officer who followed his training. According to the Department of Homeland Security's use of force policy posted on its website, the agency's officers should use force only when no reasonably effective, safe, and feasible alternative appears to exist. The document also said officers should get medical assistance as soon as practicable for anyone who appears injured. The Homeland Security policy posted online was updated in 2023. Tricia McLaughlin, a DHS spokeswoman, said in a statement Thursday that the agency's use of force policy remained the same as it was in 2023 under President Biden's administration. ICE law enforcement officers are trained to use the minimum amount of force necessary to resolve dangerous situations to prioritize the safety of the public and our officers, she said. Officers are highly trained in de-escalation tactics and regularly receive ongoing use of force training. Emily Heller, who witnessed the shooting, told the Post that the ICE agents appeared to give conflicting instructions to Good, indicating they wanted her to move her car before advancing on the vehicle. Video from Heller's phone, which she shared with the Post, showed a neighbor identifying himself as a doctor and trying to approach Good's car to provide aid. The neighbor was rebuffed by officers, one of whom said, "Give us a second, we have medics en route." A little more than a minute after the shooting, an ICE agent knelt nearby and began to open what appeared to be a trauma kit, according to available video reviewed by the Post. Paramedics arrived on the scene nearly 7 minutes after the shooting, the video showed. Authorities initially said the investigation into the shooting would be carried out by the FBI and the BCA. On Thursday morning, however, the BCA said in a statement that it had been told by the FBI that the U.S. Attorney's Office in Minneapolis had reversed course. The investigation would now be led solely by the FBI, and the BCA would no longer have access to the case materials, scene evidence, or investigative interviews necessary to complete a thorough and independent investigation. As a result, the BCA said, the agency reluctantly pulled out of the investigation. The FBI declined to comment on the BCA's statement regarding the
We are back, and you are listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. LAB would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML-FM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. Okay, next article. Let's see what I got. Okay, out of Haverhill. New assistant fire chief named, more shifts in fire department. Haverhill, there's some changing of the guards atop the Haverhill Fire Department as the firefighters were sworn in on Wednesday, including the city's first assistant fire chief. Eric Tarpey, 54, a 30-year veteran of the department, raised one hand for the swearing-in ceremony at the Haverhill City Hall to become the force's new assistant fire chief. The position is a newly created leadership role that aims to strengthen oversight and will help with upcoming transition at the top. Fire Chief Robert O'Brien, 64, prepares to retire January 17th, which has caused a ripple effect of its shifts in the ranking. The chief is only a few months away from his 65th birthday, which is the mandatory requirement age for firefighters in Massachusetts. Deputy Fire Chief and EMS Coordinator Christopher Cassati, also a 30-year-old veteran of the department, has been named the incoming fire chief. Seven members of the department were promoted on Wednesday, including Richard Chanelli to deputy chief, Keith Baldwin and Brian Ray to captains, and Timothy Stronach, Philip Sykes, and Devin Wilds to lieutenants. Tarpey joined the fire department in 1995 and has served as deputy fire chief since 2010. More than 23 years of his career have been spent in leadership positions where he has led on fire prevention, code enforcement, public education, and life safety initiatives. As a lifelong Haverhill resident, Tarpey comes from a family who has long been committed to public service. His great-grandfather, Harold Beckford, served as a Haverhill firefighter from 1926 to 1934. His grandfather, Robert Beckford, was a Haverhill police officer for 37 years, and his uncle, Arnold Hargraves, served as a Haverhill firefighter for 36 years. His son, Tyler, and nephew, Alex, are also members of the Haverhill Fire Department. With honor, I accept the position of Assistant Fire Chief. It is a privilege to continue working alongside the dedicated men and women who serve and protect the citizens of Haverhill. My 30 years of service have given me a clear understanding of our people, priorities, and the city in which I live and work. I look forward to supporting our firefighters and serving this community with integrity, humility, and a deep commitment to successfully carrying out the Haverhill Fire Department's mission through fire prevention, public education, and emergency response, Tarpey said. The assistant chief position was recommended in a 2023 outside study of the department conducted by the Center for Public Safety Management and later identified by the city as an urgent need. In the fiscal year 2026 budget, $100,000 was allocated to fund the role. Deputy Chief Eric Tarpey is a dedicated public servant who is committed to the success of the department and the well-being of Haverhill. He is known for his ability to build strong partnerships with community stakeholders, streamlining processes, and reducing fire incidents through real-time strategies. The city is fortunate to have him on the force and serve as our assistant chief, Mayor Melinda Barrett said. Over to you, Richard.
Okay, here we go. Washington. Senate checks Trump in Venezuela military threats. Associated Press. The Senate advanced a resolution Thursday that would limit President Donald Trump's ability to conduct further attacks against Venezuela, sounding a note of disapproval for his expanding ambitions in the Western Hemisphere. Democrats and five Republicans voted to advance the War Powers Resolution on a 52-47 vote and ensure a vote next week on final passage. It has virtually no chance of becoming law because Trump would have to sign it if it were to pass the Republican-controlled House. Still, it was a significant gesture that showed unease among some Republicans after the U.S. military seized Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro in a surprise nighttime raid over the weekend. Trump's administration is now seeking to control Venezuela's oil resources and its government, but the War Powers Resolution would require congressional approval for any further attacks on the South American country. To me, this is all about going forward, said Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, one of the five Republican votes. If the president should determine, you know what, I need to put those troops on the ground in Venezuela. I think that would require Congress to weigh in. The other Republicans who backed the resolution were Senators Rand Paul of Kentucky, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Susan Collins of Maine, and Todd Young of Indiana. Trump reacted to their votes by saying on social media that they should never be elected to office again. Oh, he's going to control that too. And that the vote greatly hampers the American self-defense and national security. Democrats had failed to pass several such resolutions in the months that Trump escalated his campaign against Venezuela. But lawmakers argued now that Trump has captured Maduro and set his sights on to other conquests such as Greenland. The vote presents Congress with an opportunity. This wasn't just a procedural vote. It's a clear rejection of the idea that one person can unilaterally send American sons and daughters into harm's way without Congress, without debate, said Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer of New York. Lawmakers' response to the Venezuela operation. Republican leaders have said they had... Republican leaders have said they had no advance notification of the raid early morning Saturday to see Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores. But mostly expressed satisfaction this week as top administration officials provided classified briefings on the operation. Oh. Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat of Virginia, who forced the vote on the resolution, said he believes many Republicans were caught off guard by the outcome. He said that Trump's recent comments to the New York Times suggesting U.S. oversight in Venezuela could last for years. Oh. Combined with details revealed in the classified briefings, prompted some lawmakers to conclude that this is too big to let a president do it without Congress. But they're waiting an awful long time to make decisions, aren't they? The administration has used an evolving set of legal justifications for the month-long campaign in Central and South America. From destroying alleged drug boats under authorization for the global fight against terrorism to seizing Maduro in what was ostensibly a law enforcement operation to put him on trial in the United States. Republican leaders have backed Trump. Wait a minute. Okay. I think the president has demonstrated at least already a very strong commitment to peace through strength, especially in this hemisphere, said Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota. I think Venezuela got the message loudly and clearly. A vote on a similar resolution in November narrowly failed to gain the majority needed. Rand Paul and Murkowski were the only Republicans voting in favor then. Young, in a statement, said he supported the operation to capture Maduro, but was concerned that Trump's statements that his admiration now runs Venezuela. It is unclear if that means that an American military presence will be required to stabilize the country, Young said, adding that he believed most of his constituents were not prepared to send U.S. troops to that mission. House Democrats were introducing a similar resolution Thursday. Trump criticized the Senate vote as impeding the president's authority as commander-in-chief. Oh, under the Constitution. Presidents of both parties have long argued the War Powers Act infringed on their authority, passed in 1973 in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, and over the veto of Republican President Richard Nixon. It has never succeeded in directly forcing a president to halt military action. Congress declares war while the president serves as commander-in-chief, according to the Constitution. But lawmakers have not formally declared war since World War II, granting presidents broad latitude to act unilaterally. The law requires presidents to notify Congress within 48 hours of deploying forces and to end military action within 60 to 90 days, absent of authorization limits that presidents of both parties have routinely stretched. Democrats argue those limits are being pushed further than ever. Some Republicans have gone further still, contending congressional approval is unnecessary altogether. Ooh, one person can make all these decisions. I don't think so. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, a close Trump ally who traveled with the president aboard Air Force One on Sunday, said he would be comfortable with Trump, taking over other countries without congressional approval. Wow. Including Greenland. The commander-in-chief is the commander-in-chief. They can use military force, says Graham. Graham's comments come as the administration weighs not only its next step in Venezuela, but also in Greenland. The White House has said the military is always an option when it comes to a potential American takeover of the world's largest island. Republicans have cited Greenland's strategic value, but most have balked at the idea of using the military to take the country. Some favor a potential deal to purchase the country, while others have acknowledged that it is an unlikely option when Denmark and Greenland have rejected Trump's overtures. Democrats want to get out in front of any military, action and are already preparing to respond. Arizona Senator Ruben Gallego said he expected soon to introduce a resolution to block Trump from invading Greenland. Greenland belongs to the NATO alliance ally, Denmark, which has prompted as much different response from Republican senators than the situation, which has prompted as a much different response from Republican senators than the situation in Venezuela. All right.
Salem Sweeney defends move to impeach Democratic executive counselor out of Concord, New Hampshire. Surrounded by close to 100 supporters holding signs from their hometowns Wednesday outside the State House, Executive Counselor Karen Laya Hill, Democrat from Lebanon, decried a bill seeking to impeach her, describing it as an attempt to silence voters. Representative Joe Sweeney, Republican out of Salem, who is sponsoring the measure, said the resolution is appropriate given Hill's conduct in sending an email related to voters right in an attempt to sue the state. House Resolution 41 was introduced Wednesday and will go to the House Judiciary Committee for consideration. Hill said the conduct alleging impropriety in the email was reviewed by New Hampshire Attorney General John Fermella, who found no violation of state law or ethics. Despite that, some elected officials are continuing to pursue an impeachment inquiry, but not because I did something illegal or unethical, but because they disagree with what I said, Lyatt Hill said. Filing such a resolution is their prerogative, she said, but it raises serious questions about how impeachment is being used and what message that sends. She said that in New Hampshire, removing an elected official from office has traditionally been the responsibility of voters through elections every 2 years. Impeachment is the most powerful constitutional tool the legislature has, Hill said. It exists to address bribery, corruption, or serious misconduct in office. Historically, it has been used sparingly and exclusively in cases involving judges where there is no opportunity for accountability to the voters. Last September, Sweeney filed an intent to sponsor legislation to investigate whether there were grounds to impeach Hill. This was done before Fermella issued a conclusion late last fall that closed the investigation with no charges or wrongdoing. In August, Sweeney claimed Hill used her office for political lawfare against New Hampshire's new voter ID law. Published emails show Wyatt Hill used her official office to help a partisan Washington, D.C. law firm recruit plaintiffs to sue New Hampshire over our voter ID and absentee safeguards, Sweeney said. Excuse me. That's not public service. That's political lawfare run out of a taxpayer-funded inbox. Republicans also attacked Wyatt Hill related to campaign spending. She amended her filings and repaid her campaign about $2,000, mostly for clothing and some smaller items. She is the only Democrat on the state's five-member executive council. At the gathering Wednesday, Lyatt Hill said that this is an attack on free expression, not just for her, but for everyone who participates in civic life. That chilling effect doesn't stop with elected officials, she said, but also with citizens. She said she's defending a constitutional boundary. Karen Lyatt Hill knows exactly why she is being held accountable, Sweeney wrote in an email Wednesday to indepthnewhampshire.org. She used her position as an executive counselor to recruit litigants for a lawsuit against the state of New Hampshire, Sweeney wrote. She actively assisted at an out-of-state Washington, D.C. law firm in suing our own state over common sense, pragmatic voter integrity laws supported by Granite Staters. The conduct is malpractice and maladministration. An elected official does not get to use the power of their office to aid outside interests in attacking the laws of the state they swore to uphold. That is not representation. That is an abuse of authority. Isn't our president doing that?
Mm-hmm.
Over to you, Richard.
Yeah. All right. Uplift. Family fun. Lowell Folk Festival seeks public support. Two photographs. One shows a crowd at Boarding House Park on the 38th Lowell Folk Festival in downtown Lowell, packed with people. And the other photograph shows the three young children from the McFadden family on the Bucket Brigade, a 7, 9, and 11-year-old, doing brothers and sister, doing this solicitation. All right, $10 per person donation would help cover the $1 million operating costs. Article is by Melanie Gilbert. Behind-the-scenes planning for the 39th Lowell Folk Festival is already underway for the city's signature event, which kicks off on Friday, July 24th, and runs through Sunday, July 26th. In 196 days, nearly all of downtown Lowell will be closed to vehicle traffic to create an incredible walkable festival universe, which will feature musical acts and other performers, food vendors serving a variety of distinctively culinary experiences, numerous art and family exhibits, and dance tents. Part of the festival planning is messaging to encourage the public to help support the longest-running and second-largest free folk festival in the nation. If everyone attended, Okay, I'm getting there. Oh, my. Okay. If everyone as the festival gave $10, we would cover the cost of producing the event. Director Lee Belisa said in an email Wednesday, referencing attendance figures in the tens of thousands. To produce the annual three-day event requires contributed support, Belisa said. Each year it costs close to $1 million to produce a festival of this scale, from artists performing performances and staging to sound logistics and essential public services, she said in a December Dear Festival Folk. More than half of that funding comes from partners, sponsors, grants, and public agencies, and those sources are increasingly restricted and competitive. The festival has overcome significant challenges in recent years. It was canceled in 2020 and in 2021 due to the pandemic. It came roaring back in 2022-23, only to be broadsided in 2024 by the loss of UMass Lowell's Inn and Conference Center as a hotel for visiting artists and out-of-town guests. That means they have to go to Andover or Tewksbury. The downstream impacts of the ICC's closing, that's the hotel, and moving festival bookings to the Hilton Garden Inn created significant transportation and logistical costs that continue to affect the festival's bottom line. The Tewksbury-based hotel is at least 4 miles from the festival. In 2025, the festival was rocked by a late-in-the-year cut to its programming by the Trump administration just 2 months before the opening of the annual festival. The National Endowment for the Arts initially rescinded the nonprofit's $20,000 grant funding already promised for fiscal 2025 before reinstating the funding following an appeals process after the festival closed. We were able to apply for an NEA grant for fiscal year 2027. We will see how that proceeds, Velisi said. We are hopeful that the particular funding has stabilized, but aware that the economic climate for the arts is far from secure. Yeah, real shaky. That's it. Last year, the festival ended in the black for the first time since COVID-19 pandemic. The festival is more than a music event. One of the most popular attractions at the annual event are the global food pavilions. Local nonprofits prepare on-site and sell dishes representing a number of the ethnic cultures to be found in New England. The cuisine ranges from Greek, Filipino, Hispanic, Jamaican, Southeast Asian, mixed African, and Middle Eastern. The vendors pay a booth fee to participate, but the proceeds are a fundraiser for their nonprofit programs and services. Proceeds from vendor food and beverage sales and parking do not support festival operations. Oh, Felici said by email. Unpredictable weather can be a wild card for both festival attendance and finances. The first 2 days of last year's festival brought heat, humidity, and sunshine, while Sunday brought steady rain, followed by downpour that let up in time for the final acts of the night. Whoa. Alcohol sales in 2025 were lower than expected, but that matches parking data that we have that shows lower attendance on Sunday with the rain discouraging audiences from coming out. Last summer, Acton's Discovery Museum made its debut, but appearance at the Lowell Folk Festival, part of the festival's efforts to attract families and new audiences. Museum-sponsored activities along Lowell's main thoroughfare from Dutton to Central Street was a vibrant, full-sensory hub for kids and families to explore, learn, and play together. Anchoring the playscape at the corner of Merrimack and Central Streets was an area dedicated to youth performances and family-friendly acts throughout the weekend. Several vendors contacted by the Sun said they intended to return to this year's festival, but declined specific comment since discussions were in the early stages. The festival thrives because of its thousands of visitors, but it survives because of its hundreds of volunteers and donors. Volunteers drive the shuttle vans to transport artists between the hotel and their downtown venues. Other volunteers staff the recycling tents, stock ice and supplies for vendors and performers, and act as festival ambassadors. The annual event is also made possible by the volunteers with the Bucket Brigade, who pass out Mardi Gras-style beads in exchange for donations. The bucket amounts are not disclosed due to security concerns for the volunteers walking the festival ground. But Belisi said the money collected during the 2025 festival was about the same as the previous year. However, individual donations currently make up a small portion of the festival's overall funding. But the strong turnout of support earlier in the year after the NEA grant was revoked led to a greater online donation year than previously seen. Belisi said the road ahead continues to be an uphill climb. Artists and producer fees continue to increase, and inflation is increasing the cost of other goods and services. Still, the show must go on, and Belisi said the festival team is continuing to try and make the festival the best it can possibly be for the community. The Lowell Folk Festival is produced by the Lowell Festival Foundation, the City of Lowell, Greater Lowell Chamber of Commerce, Greater Lowell Community Foundation, the Lowell National Historical Park, National Council for the Traditional Arts, and Revolutionary Valley. It also enjoys support from the Nancy L. Donahue, Rockland Trust Bank, and the Saab Family Foundation, among others. Rather than cutting programming, we continue to explore partnerships that help share costs and inspire giving, she said. Belisi hopes to secure the festival's future by asking the festival goers to reframe the free festival as an opportunity to support a cherished tradition that provides 20 hours of music across four stages for 3 days. She noted that commercial concerts at local venues can charge door ticket fees of more than $20 per act per night. The folk festival is certainly worth a $10 donation to keep it alive for many years to come. To donate to the Lowell Folk Festival, visit lowellfolkfestival.org, pages, and donate. All right.
I have, out of North Andover, the planning board wants a local country club to do its due diligence before allowing it to cut down more than 30 trees along the lake that serves as the town's water supply. The planning board denied an application from the North Andover Country Club for an emergency watershed special permit at its meeting on Tuesday. Boyd Halk, the country club's general manager, proposed removing 31 upland trees on the property of 500 Great Pond Road that are within the high water of elevation of the Lake Cochichewick and the topping of large shrubs. Trees and shrubs proposed to be removed are on the ninth fairway along the lake behind the club's playground and tennis courts. Shrubs would be topped around the first and ninth fairways. The emergency request application prepared by Merrimack Engineering Services said the trees covered by the proposal were compromised after being submerged in high waters. The tree removal, Hoke told the board, would also help the country club better prepare for future flood events and avoid situations where dead trees cause more harm. The trees proposed to be cut down are not native to the wetland area and would not survive long-term if submerged underwater again during floods like the one that hit the Merrimack Valley in 2023, Hulk said. As a club, we have no idea if we're ever going to get floods again like that we had that year, but We could have multiple ones, he said. The emergency permit was sought because of the club's short window of January to February for the ground to be frozen and allow heavy trucks on the golf course without damage to it. Director of Planning Jean Enright said there is an emergency permit provision in the bylaw. In her time, Enright stated that she's never seen one sought or approved. She said she cautioned the applicant, the board may want to consider either a stormwater or arborist review. She added that the Conservation Commission would likely want to seek a review by an arborist as to the tree's health, any effect on the shoreline if they are removed, and any impact to the lake. Chair Eaton Goldberg said that the proposal does not call for an emergency provision and needs to go through the proper process of approval assessments, peer reviews, and public hearings because of how close the trees are to an important asset. Board member Peter Boynton said he was hesitant to cut trees in a watershed close to the lake, stressing how the lake is the sole source of drinking water in town, which needs to be protected. Vegetation along the shoreline plays a part in protecting the water, filtering the stormwater, and helping prevent erosion before it gets to the lake. Boynton called the country club an institutional landowner to protect an asset that affects every single person in town. You are the neighbor of every resident of town, Boynton said. Goldberg also said the board has gone through lengths to tell people not to cut down trees and punish them when they've done it without going through the board's review. The board determined the emergency permit did not meet criteria for it to be issued, but tree removal is something that can be reviewed when going through the appropriate permitting process. Over to you, Richard.
Okay, here we go. On to Reed. Highlands Neighborhood Meeting. Lowell, the first meeting of the Highlands Neighborhood Association takes place on Monday, January 12th, which is coming up, at the Lowell Catholic Auditorium, 530 Stevens Street. Doors open at 6:30 for a 7 p.m. meeting, which starts at that time. Meetings are generally held the second Monday of each month. The agenda for Monday's meeting is a crime update from the Lowell Police Neighborhood Response Unit, led by Captain Daniel Damaris, a 10-person unit that addresses neighborhood issues throughout the city. There will be an introduction to the new city councilors who were inaugurated Monday, followed by an informal forum between the four candidates for the first Middlesex State Senate seat. The meeting closes with neighborhood updates and announcements and feedback. The next meeting is scheduled for February 9th. For more information, email our co-chairs Nancy Judge at njudge7@aol.com or Ryan Fallier at ryanfallier45@gmail.com, but no telephone numbers. Okay. Bystander Know Your Rights Training. The Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition will hold a Bystander Know Your Rights Training at noon? Thursday, January 15th via Zoom at noon. The training aims to provide participants with tools and strategies to safely and effectively respond when witnessing immigration enforcement. Topics covered will include how to recognize an immigration and customs enforcement operation, clear do's and don'ts, safe practices for offering support, and the use of community hotlines, mutual aid, and accompaniment programs. To register, visit BITLY3N5RLZN. But again, no telephone number. Save the date, Living the Dream. The annual Living the Dream celebration, memorializing Martin Luther King Jr., will take place on Monday, January 19th. On Monday, January 19th, from 1 to 3 p.m.
That's Martin Luther King Day is acknowledged that day, so a lot of businesses are closed.
The Holy Ghost Society, 65 Village Street. I don't know what that is. This year's theme is Uniting a Community, Building a Future. Living the Dream Partners invite the public to celebrate King's legacy. A Living the Dream Partners Award will be bestowed to a deserving community member, an organization, and an emerging leader. For registration, donations, and sponsorship information, visit Middlesex Ed Advancement Living the Dream sponsor, HTML. Okay.
All right. I've got Merrimack Valley in a minute. Murder Mystery Dinner in Methuen. Out of Methuen, take part in an evening of suspense, laughter, and unexpected twists at the Dinner Detective True Crime Murder Mystery Dinner at 6 p.m. on Friday, January 16th at Pica's Deli and Ice Cream, 18 Ears Village Road. Throughout the night, folks will work to crack a case while enjoying a full-course dinner. But beware, the culprit is in plain sight, blending in with the crowd, organizers said. Anyone could be the killer, and even you might become a prime suspect before the night is over. Tickets to the event cost $70. Visit facebook.com/Pica's Deli or call 351-204-7799 for more information. Out of Boston, the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority and Keolis Community Services posted a reminder to passengers that commuter rail trains will not service North Station on select weekends from January through April. This will allow for necessary signal improvement work just outside of North Station. The work will take place on the following dates: January 17th and 18th, January 31st and February 1st, February 28th and March 1st, March 7th and 8th, March 21st and 22nd, March 28th and 29th, April 11th and 12th, and April 24th to the 27th. Normal train services will operate to and from North Station on January 24th and 25th. A previous release included these dates for construction. On the Haverhill Line, Orange Line, service will replace regular train service between North Station and Oak Grove. On the Newburyport-Rockport Line, local and express shuttle buses will replace regular train services between North Station and Swampscott. Local buses will service Wonderland for a Blue Line connection. On the Lowell Line, local and express shuttle buses will replace regular train service between North Station and Anderson-Woburn Station. On the Fitchburg Line, Red Line to Green Line services will replace regular train service between North Station and Porter. Schedules are available at mbta.com/CR. Okay, Martin Luther King celebration set for January 19th out of Andover. Join the celebration of unity at Andover's 19th annual MLK Junior Day event from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Monday, January 19th at Andover Baptist Church, 7 Central Street. The Day of Unity, Reflection, and Community will honor the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. The keynote speaker of the event is Dr. Patrick Tutwiler, the State Secretary of Education. Attendees will enjoy musical performances, King Jr. recitations, and more. Music will be led by the Andover High School Chamber Choir, the Chorale Majority Gospel Choir, Rabbi Iden Ireland of the Congregation Ahavat Alom, and the Ahavat Ensemble, and the Gospel Jazz Ensemble. Ralph Bledsoe will recite King's I Have a Dream speech. This year's themes: United We Stand, Divided We Fall, Strengthen Our Shared Faith and Common Humanity. For more information, visit AndoverBaptistChurch.org. Over to you, Richard.
Okay, here we go. This is really long. Three columns. Hospital pricing abuse squeezing Massachusetts employers threatening care.
Wait, hang on. Three columns long, it's 10 of.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't do that one. I could do something small. I have a couple of small ones. Okay, so challengers allege fraud in signature collection. Hang on, because I don't know why this isn't letting me open it. Hold on one second. Sorry. Okay, let's see. Out of Boston, the proposed ballot initiative to repeal adult-use recreational marijuana faces a new challenge. Challengers of the proposal filed an objection January 2nd with Secretary of State William Galvin's office. The State Ballot Law Commission plans to hold a pre-hearing conference on the objection January 12th and a hearing on January 13th. The objection is centered around concerns about how signatures in support of the proposed ballot initiative were collected. Thomas Kiley, an attorney leading the challenge, told the news service. Paid signature gatherers at Trader Joe's in Hanover, Market Basket facilities in Plymouth, Whole Foods in Weymouth, and in parking lots around Gillette Stadium in Foxborough have misled voters with respect to what they're signing and thus obtained signatures fraudulently, the objection states. Among the misleading statements were assertions that the law proposed on the petition blanks that they were signing would get fentanyl off the streets, providing affordable housing in their communities, or fund public parks, according to the objection. Each of these assertions would be apt with respect to one or more of the other initiative petitions approved by the Attorney General, but have nothing to do with Initiative Petition 1E. The objection asserts paid signature gatherers often gave only the background of the petition to voters whose signatures they obtained. The backside doesn't bear the summary of the proposed law, the objection adds. Wendy Wakeman, chair of the ballot committee backing the ballot proposal, stood firm behind the signature gathering, saying they were collected with integrity and by trained professional signature gatherers. We stand by the number, Wakeman said. The State Elections Division certified 78,301 signatures from the petition in December. The petition needed at least 74,574 certified signatures to proceed in the process. Wakeman said opponents to the ballot proposal have raised concern about signature collection for months and said that it's predictable and that they should issue an objection. She's confident that the proposal will stay on track to the 2026 ballot. Galvin addressed the objection on Tuesday afternoon as his office delivered boxes of ballot questions to the State House. The objectors are based on the people who now are in retail cannabis businesses, Galvin said. They've got to come up with enough signatures knocked off to disqualify the petition. It has to be based on evidence. It can't be assertion. So it's going to be a challenge. You're talking tens of thousands of signatures to come up with enough that are going to be disqualified in a short period of time because the ballot law commission is time limited, 10 days, I think. So good luck. I hope they have a nice time, Galvin added. Richard, do you need more time?
Well, here we go. Russia harshly condemns U.S. seizure of oil tanker. Russia on Thursday strongly condemned the U.S. seizure of an oil tanker, heralding a new chill in relations between Moscow and Washington that could spread to other areas and affect President Donald Trump's efforts to persuade Russia to end its nearly four-year war in the Ukraine. The seizure Wednesday of the Russian flag, that was a flag that was another country before, flag tanker in the North Atlantic can only lead to a further escalation of military and political tensions in the Europe-Atlantic region, as well as visible lowering of the threshold for the use of force against peaceful shipping, the Russian Foreign Ministry said. Russian President Vladimir Putin hasn't yet commented on the seizure of the tanker and has remained silent about the U.S. capture of Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro, which his diplomats have denounced as a blatant act of aggression. And then on top of that, we have the Pope indicates new governing style for Catholic Church. Vatican City, Pope Leo XIV said Thursday he intended to bring the world's Catholic cardinals together annually, indicating a new governing style for the Church that involves consulting its top leaders regularly and as a group. At the end of his first consistory, as such meetings are called, Leo asked cardinals to return to Rome for a second session at the end of June, and from then onwards, on an annual basis for 3 to 4 days each year, Vatican spokesman Matteo Bruni said. Cardinals said the proposed date for the second session would be June 27th and 28th, before a big June 29th feast day. Pope Francis had largely eschewed consistories and the College of Cardinals as a whole to help him govern. Instead, he had a hand-picked group of 9 cardinals who met every few months at the Vatican to advise him.
I got today in history to wrap us up.
Go.
Okay. January 9th, the iPhone makes its debut. Is Friday, January 9th, the ninth day of 2026. There are 356 days left in the year. Today in history, on January 9th, 2007, Apple CEO Steve Jobs introduced the iPhone at the Macworld Conference in San Francisco. Also on this date, in 1861, Mississippi became the second state to secede from the Union. The same day, the Star of the West, a merchant vessel bringing reinforcements and supplies to federal troops at Fort Sumter, South Carolina, retreated because of artillery fire. In 1916, the World War I Battle of Gallipoli ended with an Ottoman Empire victory as Allied forces withdrew. In 1945, during World War II, American forces began landing on the shores of Lingayen Gulf in the Philippines as the Battle of Luzon got underway, resulting in an Allied victory over Imperial Japanese forces. In 2005, Mohammed Abbas was elected president of the Palestine Authority following the death of Yasser Arafat the previous November. In 2018, downpours sent mud and boulders roaring down Southern California hillsides that had been stripped of vegetation by a wildfire. More than 20 people died and hundreds of homes were damaged or destroyed. And lastly, in 2022, 17 people, including 8 children, died after a fire sparked by a malfunctioning space heater filled a high-rise apartment building with smoke in New York City borough of the Bronx. It was the city's deadliest blaze in 3 decades. And on that note, we'd like to thank you for listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to LAB Radio. Request a free specialized radio receiver, or for more information about our radio reading services, call LAB at 978-454-5704. You can listen to Lab Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069. Visit our website where you can tune into LAB Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. This has been Diane and Richard. We bid you a fair adieu. Is that the expression, I think? Hopefully you'll have a good weekend. I think it's going to be partly sunny and partly rainy, so maybe a good movie weekend. So whatever you do, do it with family, do it with fun, and do it by being kind to one another. Thank you.
A graphic outlook does present a troubling future for the country's economy, fiscal well-being, and core social safety net programs. The size of the U.S. population is set to stagnate by 2056, then begin a gradual decline. According to projections Wednesday from the Congressional Budget Office, lawmakers' nonpartisan bookkeeper. Without immigration, the population would begin to shrink in 2030, with deaths outnumbering births. In its paper, though, Heritage casts the declining birth rate as a larger problem for the country that points to a more existential loss of national character, what the group calls a profound cultural malaise in which a growing share of adults feel that they should not or cannot, and therefore do not, form families. Some of the paper's conclusions drew criticisms from across the ideological spectrum. That concludes this Friday's reading from the Washington Post. My name is Jean, and it's been a pleasure to read for you.
You were just listening to the Washington Post on the Talking Information Center. Please stay tuned for more programming, and thank you for listening.
Here's the forecast for the Boston and South Shore area on the Talking Information Center from the National Weather Service. For today, partly sunny, temperatures in the upper 40s. Clouds move in for this evening, some showers, temperatures dropping to the upper 30s. For Saturday, cloudy, temperatures in the mid-40s. The sun rose this morning at 7:13, setting at 4:30 this afternoon. Stay tuned for more heading your way next on the Talking Information Center.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window.